So I want you to imagine stepping into a healthcare system that's responsible for millions of people.
Right.
Like, it's a massive, incredibly complex network, and they're dealing with literally everything, from infectious diseases to chronic aging to acute mental health
Yeah,
crises.
the whole spectrum.
Exactly. But there is a huge catch here. Every individual clinic, hospital, and care center in the system is essentially walled off from the others.
Completely isolated.
Yeah, they operate in this extreme isolation. So it creates this massive systemic blind spot. You know, like
Yeah.
a doctor in one facility has almost no efficient way to know what a doctor in the next state over is doing.
I mean, that sounds like a logistical impossibility, but
Yeah.
that is actually the day-to-day reality of how our correctional healthcare system
It
operates.
really is. So, welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are exploring the inaugural issue of Core Pearls, which is dated May 2026.
Yeah, it's a fascinating document.
It is. It's a quarterly clinical and policy briefing from the American College of Correctional Physicians, or the ACCP. And their goal with this document is to bridge that exact blind spot for the professionals working inside these facilities.
Because the medical professionals working behind bars, they're dealing with a uniquely siloed field.
Right.
They need a centralized way to track the clinical literature, the regulatory shifts, and, well, the court rulings that are constantly reshaping their daily practice.
Because it's just so different from a standard community hospital.
Entirely distinct, yeah.
So, our mission today is to really unpack this totally distinct medical ecosystem for you. We're going to look at the cutting edge of healthcare behind bars. We'll explore how court rulings literally dictate medical policy, how new drug models are like changing infectious disease control, and what happens when an entire incarcerated population just fundamentally ages.
There's a lot of ground to cover.
There is. Okay, let's unpack this. In the free world, if you're a doctor, your practice is usually driven by clinical guidelines, right?
Yeah, standard protocols.
Like, the American Medical Association recommends a certain protocol, so you follow it. But behind bars, healthcare is incredibly reliant on the gavel.
It is a fundamentally different paradigm. The courts, in many ways, act as the ultimate chief medical officer for these facilities.
Wow, the chief medical officer.
Yeah, and we see this vividly in a massive February 2026 ruling out of Arizona. The case is Jensen v. Thornell.
Okay.
Federal Judge Rosalind Silver didn't just, issue a fine or a warning.
Yeah.
She ordered a receiver to completely take over the medical and mental health care system of the Arizona Department of Corrections.
Wait, really? So the state effectively just loses control over its own agency's healthcare operations.
Yeah, it's the scale of the intervention, yeah. What's fascinating here is this is the most significant structural remedy order in correctional medicine since the famous Plata case out in California.
Right, Plata was huge.
It was. It illustrates the mechanical threshold of the legal system. When systemic issues go unresolved for over a decade of litigation, the court just assumes control.
To ensure the Eighth Amendment is upheld, right?
Exactly. The constitutional right against cruel and unusual punishment, which mandates adequate medical care.
So that structural takeover in Arizona really sets the stage for how these individual, highly specific treatment mandates play out on the ground.
It does.
And, you know, we have to look at gender-affirming care here. It's obviously a highly debated political topic right now in the broader culture.
Very much so.
But I want to make it super clear to you listening. Our goal here isn't to endorse any specific viewpoint. We're strictly looking at this through the lens of a prison doctor. For them, it is strictly a complex legal and clinical puzzle.
Right. They aren't looking at politics. They are looking at conflicting court orders and medical standards.
Exactly. So how does that actually work in practice?
Well, the sheer volume of overlapping directives creates a uniquely challenging environment. Let's look at the federal level first.
Okay.
In a case called Kingdom v. Trump, there's a class-wide preliminary injunction out of a D.C. federal court. That injunction currently requires the Federal Bureau of Prisons to continue hormone therapy and provide social transition accommodations. And that applies to approximately 2,000 transgender patients in its custody.
But the prescriber doesn't just look at that single court order, do they?
No, not at all. The Bureau of Prisons itself issued a superseding policy in February 2026.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and on top of that, there's a Department of Justice memo from December 2025 regarding PREA auditors, that's the Prison Rape Elimination Act, that moves in a very different administrative direction.
Navigating that sounds like a daily operational hurdle. Just layers of bureaucracy.
It really is. And while the federal system is managing those layers, the states are embroiled in their own localized battles.
Right, like what's happening in Georgia.
Exactly. In Georgia, a federal district court permanently enjoined, which means they formally blocked Senate Bill 185 in a case called Doe v. Carr.
Okay, and what did that state law do?
That law barred hormone therapy in the Georgia Department of Corrections.
So the state legislature banned the treatment, but then the federal court stepped in and ruled that under the Eighth Amendment, a categorical ban was unconstitutional.
Right, and that ruling is currently being appealed to the 11th Circuit.
It's just a legal tightrope.
It is. If you're a physician in one of these facilities, yeah, you're trying to make intake and treatment decisions based on the Eighth Amendment, the clinical standards from WPSPath version 8, which is the World Professional Association for Transgender Health,
right,
and these constantly shifting court injunctions.
It is a legal minefield, but, you know, while the courts are dictating the overarching structure, there is a much more immediate, literally life or death crisis these facilities face every single day at intake.
Yeah, the overdose crisis.
Exactly. And I want to share a staggering statistic from a 2026 study published in the journal Addiction.
The Stanford one, right?
Yes. Investigators from Stanford, the VA, and the Office of National Drug Control Policy modeled this out. In 2022, 21,784 people released from U.S. jails and prisons died of an opioid overdose.
That single data point really frames the entire public health challenge we're facing.
It's unbelievable. That is 27% of all U.S. opioid overdose deaths that year.
Over a quarter.
Over a quarter of all fatal opioid overdoses in the whole country are people who just recently walked out of a jail or prison.
Yeah, because when you consider how tolerance drops during incarceration, releasing someone into the community without a medical bridge is incredibly dangerous.
So the jail-to-community bridge is arguably the most critical intervention point in public health today. How are they actually addressing that medically?
Well, the medical mechanism relies heavily on MOU, which stands for Medications for Opioid Use Disorder.
Okay, like what?
These are pharmacological interventions like buprenorphine and methadone. They basically stabilize the brain's receptors.
And the data supporting those interventions is remarkably strong. I saw the New England Journal of Medicine published a study in 2025.
The Massachusetts pilot.
Right. They looked at a 7-jail Mayo-Ude pilot program in Massachusetts, followed over 6,400 individuals to see what actually happens when you initiate this medication behind the wall.
And the outcomes were definitive. Participants who received buprenorphine or methadone while in jail had much higher engagement with community treatment after release.
Which is exactly what you want.
Exactly. And more importantly, they experienced lower rates of all-cause mortality, lower rates of fatal overdoses, and lower rates of reincarceration compared to those who didn't get the medication.
But, you know, I have a question about this. Because the drug supply in 2026 is totally different than it was even 5 years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
If someone comes into a county jail off the street tonight, they aren't just detoxing from heroin or, like, pure fentanyl anymore. What are they actually detoxing from?
That is the core clinical challenge facing intake staff today. We're talking about xylodaner, which is commonly known on the street as trank.
Crank, right.
The Office of National Drug Control Policy designated it an emerging threat back in 2023. And it's now detected in opioid samples in nearly all U.S. states.
So because it's a mixture, it's like having two different alarm systems going off in a house simultaneously.
That's a good way to put it.
Like, buprenorphine turns off the opioid alarm, but the xylazine alarm is wired to a completely different circuit. So the sirens are still blaring, causing massive withdrawal, even with traditional treatment.
That is a perfect recollection of the mechanism at play. Xylazine is an alpha-2 adrenergic agonist.
Okay.
It's a veterinary tranquilizer. It is not an opioid. So when a patient goes into withdrawal from a fentanyl-xylazine mixture, giving them opioid agonist therapy like buprenorphine only quiets the opioid receptors.
And the xylazine withdrawal just continues.
Yeah, within 12 to 24 hours, the unmanaged xylazine withdrawal triggers intense autonomic symptoms, severe anxiety, hypertension, tachycardia, and profound agitation.
Wow. So the prescriber has to piece together an entirely separate regimen just to handle that secondary withdrawal.
They rely heavily on adjunctive therapies. The clinical literature points to using other alpha-2 agonists, like clonidine, to manage those specific autonomic symptoms.
It sounds incredibly intensive.
It is, and furthermore, xylazine causes severe vasoconstriction, which leads to necrotic skin and soft tissue lesions.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we're talking about deep, severe wounds that require surgical evaluation and rigorous infection prevention the moment a patient steps into the intake bay.
And those open wounds, combined with the reality of a crowded, closed facility and, you know, high rates of intravenous drug use, it creates an environment that's highly susceptible to infectious disease transmission.
Absolutely.
Like if a patient comes in with an untreated infection, their proximity to others becomes a massive operational focus.
Hepatitis C and HIV are two of the most resource-intensive conditions in this ecosystem.
Let's start with Hep C. The clinical standard is moving toward universal opt-out screening at intake now, right?
Yes.
Rather than just testing people who explicitly admit to risk factors like sharing needles. But curing Hep C is notoriously expensive.
Very expensive. The direct-acting antivirals that cure Hep C are clinical marvels. They're incredibly effective, often with cure rates above 95%.
Which is amazing.
It is, but the list prices are a significant barrier for state budgets. A drug like Mavurette has a list price of around $26,400 for an 8-week course.
26 grand for one person.
Right. And Epclusa is roughly $74,760 for a 12-week course.
That's just wild.
There are generic and pharmacy coupon options that bring those numbers down. But multiplying even a discounted rate by thousands of infected patients, it creates a staggering financial burden.
So this proposed solution pending in Congress is fascinating mechanically. It's the Cure Hepatitis C Act of 2025, Senate Bill 1941.
Right.
And it proposes a national subscription procurement model for these drugs. It's essentially the Netflix model for Hep C medication.
The Netflix model, yeah.
Like instead of a State Department of Corrections paying 26 grand per individual patient, they'd pay a massive flat subscription fee to the drug manufacturer.
That model changes the entire calculus of disease eradication. By paying a flat rate, the state or federal system gets unlimited access to the antivirals.
Which is huge.
They can treat as many patients as they identify without the budget scaling linearly with every new diagnosis.
And alongside that Hep C procurement model, we're also seeing a massive paradigm shift in how HIV is prevented, specifically for short-stay populations like county jails.
Yes.
In June 2025, the FDA approved an injectable drug called lenacapavir under the brand name Yeztugo for HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis, or pre-AP.
And what makes Yeztugo fundamentally different for a correctional environment is the dosing schedule.
Yeah.
It is a twice-a-year injection, one shot every 26 weeks.
That's a game changer. Think about the mechanics of compliance here. In a jail, you might have someone in custody for just 30 or 60 days.
Yep.
Trying to ensure they take a daily pill while inside requires immense staff resources. And ensuring they keep taking that daily pill the minute they're released back into the community, where they might be facing homelessness, loss of insurance, or active addiction, it's practically impossible.
The single injection bypasses that entire nightmare of daily pill compliance upon release.
How much does it cost, though?
The cost is significant, at about $28,218 annually.
Okay.
But from a public health continuity standpoint, the patient is protected for 6 months. A facility can literally time a patient's second injection to coincide with their handoff back into the community.
Wow. So it ensures they remain protected during their most vulnerable transition period.
It redefines continuity of care.
Now, the briefing also points out that while we have these high-tech solutions for HIV and Hep C, older airborne diseases require constant vigilance, too.
They really do.
The briefing highlights a recent tuberculosis outbreak in a Washington state prison that resulted in 25 active cases and 244 latent conversions.
And the underlying cause of that outbreak is something anyone who lived through the last few years can understand. Standard annual TB screening had been suspended during the operational chaos of COVID-19.
Just paused entirely.
Yeah. It only took 2 years of interrupted screening for transmission to quietly resume and snowball into a major outbreak.
That really highlights the sheer epidemiological undertaking required just to maintain baseline health.
Absolutely.
Facilities are managing latent TB with regimens like 3-HP, which is a 3-month, once-weekly antibiotic treatment that requires strict observation.
Right.
They're also implementing protocols like DoxyPIP, where a patient takes doxycycline within 72 hours of exposure to prevent sexually transmitted infections like syphilis and chlamydia from taking hold.
So while the medical staff are battling what people bring into the jails and prisons, the acute addictions, the infectious diseases, they're also facing a slow-moving crisis based on what happens as people simply stay there.
The demographics are fundamentally changing.
Yes.
We are seeing the graying of the American prison population. According to a September 2025 report from the ACLU and the UT Austin LBJ School, one in six U.S. prisoners is now aged 55 or older.
One in six.
Yeah. And if current trends hold, by 2030, That demographic could account for one-third of the entire population.
That demographic shift completely alters the mission of correctional medicine.
Wow.
Facilities built for security and acute trauma care are now having to function as high-security nursing homes.
That's wild to think about.
Staff are managing dementia, mobility issues, and complex chronic diseases in environments that were never designed for geriatric care.
And the states are being forced to respond to this legislatively, right?
Yes.
Because the operational costs and ethical logistics are just overwhelming. In Maryland, Senate Bill 181 just took effect. This law authorizes geriatric parole consideration for individuals 65 or older who have served at least 20 years.
In Illinois, House Bill 2397 now requires the Department of Corrections to publish an annual report specifically on hospice and palliative care services.
What did the data out of Illinois show?
It really illustrates the severity of the issue. The average age of death in their Department of Corrections is just 56 years old.
56? Wow.
Yeah. Furthermore, they found that over a recent 10-month period, out of 488 in-custody deaths, 404 of those individuals did not receive any hospice services prior to passing.
It points to a system just struggling to adapt its physical and medical infrastructure to end-of-life care.
Very much so.
And alongside the challenges of the aging population, the ACCP briefing highlights major updates to mental health operations. In April 2026, new standards took effect specifically aimed at suicide prevention,
which remains one of the leading causes of death in U.S. jails.
Right. So what do the new standards focus on?
They focus heavily on the highest risk windows. Clinical data shows that the first 24 to 72 hours of admission are incredibly dangerous as the psychological shock of incarceration hits the individual.
And the other massive risk window is the period immediately following release from restrictive housing.
Often referred to as solitary confinement, yeah.
Because the transition back to general population can trigger severe acute distress.
Exactly. So the new standards mandate that closed circuit video monitoring is only a supplement to, and never a substitute for, direct human observation for patients on watch.
So actual people have to check on them.
Right. They also require documented proactive follow-up by a qualified mental health professional, specifically after someone is removed from suicide precautions. It shifts the focus toward continuous patient engagement rather than just passive monitoring.
Okay, so we've explored the medical complexities of people coming into the system and the chronic realities of people aging inside. Let's look at the mechanics of release.
Because eventually, the vast majority of these individuals do leave custody.
Right. So how does the handover to the outside world actually work from a financial and bureaucratic standpoint?
Well, the most critical element of a successful release is continuity of care. And historically, the largest systemic barrier to that continuity was the termination of Medicaid.
Termination meaning it just gets cut off?
Right. Previously, when someone went to prison, their Medicaid coverage was terminated entirely.
Meaning when they were released, they had to start the application process from scratch.
Which takes time.
Yeah. It creates a gap of weeks or months where they cannot afford their MOD, their psychiatric medications, or their insulin. It's a life-threatening administrative delay.
A massive legislative shift aimed at closing that gap just took effect on January 1st, 2026.
Oh, really?
The Consolidated Appropriations Act now requires states to suspend rather than terminate Medicaid coverage upon incarceration.
Just suspending the coverage changes the mechanics entirely. The moment they're released, their coverage can be immediately reactivated in the system without a new application. They can theoretically walk out of the facility, go straight to a community pharmacy, and have their life-saving prescriptions covered on day one.
However, delivering all of this complex care inside the walls, the expensive Hep C drugs, the intensive xylazine detox, the geriatric management, it's largely done by private corporations contracted by the state or county.
Right, the contractor.
And the briefing paints a highly volatile picture of this contractor landscape.
It is a precarious business sector right now. In May 2026, YesCare, one of the major national providers, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection.
Following massive jury verdicts and canceled contracts across multiple states.
Yeah, the Alabama Department of Corrections actually terminated their billion-dollar contract with YesCare. And they had to enter into a 24-month emergency agreement with another company, NAFCARE, just to maintain basic clinical operations.
Meanwhile, another giant in the space, WellPath, recently emerged from its own Chapter 11 reorganization.
When these massive medical contractors go bankrupt or change hands rapidly, it sends shockwaves through the local facilities.
You see sudden changes to electronic health records, medication formularies, and basic credentialing workflows for the doctors and nurses on the floor.
We also see immense operational stressors in federal immigration detention. And keeping strict neutrality here, just looking at the clinical data, the numbers highlight a system under severe pressure.
What do the numbers show?
A March 2026 report from KFF notes an average daily census of over 68,000 individuals in ICE detention.
That same report identified 46 deaths in ICE custody since January 20, 2025.
Right.
Notably, the clinical data showed that 32 of those individuals had documented worsening of pre-existing medical conditions while in custody.
To give a complete picture of those operational stressors, the briefing also notes a CNN investigation. It highlighted severe medical understaffing within these ICE facilities, which compounds the difficulty of managing those worsening conditions.
Systemic.
Yeah. Whether it's state prisons, county jails, or federal detention centers, the providers are dealing with a constant flow of patients with complex needs and a severe lack of resources.
Which is exactly why the ACCP distributes this briefing. It provides isolated medical professionals with the necessary visibility into what clinical strategies are working, what legal precedents are failing, and what regulatory shifts are coming next.
Let's recap what we have covered today. Correctional medicine is a high-stakes, intensely siloed ecosystem.
It really is.
Prescribers are balancing eighth-amendment mandates from federal judges, navigating the fallout of billion-dollar contractor bankruptcies, and trying to implement revolutionary drug models like Yeztugo for HIV and Mavyret for Hep C.
All at the same time.
Right. And all of this is happening while they manage the day-to-day realities of our nation's most acute health crises, from a rapidly aging demographic to the devastating effects of the xylazine epidemic.
The ACCP has explicitly laid out several topics to watch moving forward. For anyone involved in health policy or clinical practice, the evolution of OUD programs and the related civil litigation will be paramount.
Facility leaders must constantly review their withdrawal management designs.
And the rollout of the Medicaid suspension requirements is another massive development to monitor.
Yeah.
The operational mechanics of ensuring that suspension rather than termination actually happens successfully at intake and that reactivation happens instantly at release will largely dictate the success of community reentry and continuity of care for the next decade.
Here is where it gets incredibly interesting, and this is the thought I want to leave you with today. Consider the physical structure of a jail or a prison. The concrete walls, the razor wire, the secure doors, they are masterfully designed to keep people securely inside. But when you look at it through the lens of public health, those walls are entirely porous.
The exchange between the facility and the community is constant.
People are released back into their neighborhoods every single day. Staff walk in and out every shift.
Yeah.
With 27% of all opioid overdose deaths linked to recently incarcerated individuals and infectious diseases like tuberculosis and hepatitis C crossing that threshold constantly, is it possible that the key to fixing the broader public healthcare system in America actually requires us to first fix the correctional healthcare system?
The data suggests it's a question we simply cannot afford to ignore anymore.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.